Thank you and good morning. I'm talking about Nature Wilderness and Creation Care, the example of Canadian National Parks. And I'd like to say before I begin that I received funding from the Priscilla and Stan Gray Trust. I arrived here on Wednesday night, and on Thursday morning I discovered that I received the funding to pay for my airfare. So that's great. This presentation actually began a long time ago. It's still a work in progress. But it goes back to 2003, faculty seminar at Calvin College, and it was on Christianity and Environment, and I began thinking about creation care as relates to management of parks. I had accepted actually the ASA conference here in 2004, but then I became engaged for a very around that time, so I had to cancel, and then I had accepted in Glasgow in 2007, I think it was, but I didn't get funding. So I had a chance now to do it, but my thinking has evolved a little bit, but it's still a work in progress. As you can see, I enjoy parks, my family enjoy parks. Those are all national parks from Waterton to Cape Breton, Highlands, Banff, Forio, and so on. So I'll begin with a little bit of my own personal journey. I grew up in a family where we operated the parks, usually provincial parks, and then I entered a program in undergraduate studies in recreation. And in 1980, I took a course, Recreation Resources Conservation, which is basically a park management course. And I'll come back to that a little bit later. Then when I did my PhD much later in 1995 at the University of Waterloo, I took a course in ecosystem approach to park planning. And a lot of things had changed during the time I did my undergraduate and did my PhD, and parks were managed differently. And this was really an eye-opener to me because we were talking about ecological integrity. Jonathan Bayer is actually the supervisor of Stephen Woodley, who's sort of the guru of ecological integrity in the world. Then I was teaching at Paul Eagles for park management class two times, so that I did my PhD. Later, I taught a park management course, and since 2007 or so, every second year, I teach a park management course at the University of Ottawa, actually the same course I took back in 1980. So I've used all four editions of the textbook Parks and Protected Areas in Canada, Management and Planning. So this is a textbook specifically for Canada, and I'm going to be talking a bit about that and how it describes the evolution that has occurred. So just give you a little bit of history. Sorry, there's a mistake out there. That's 1885, the first national park in Canada. And you may not know that Canada is the first country in the world to have a park service in 1911. The United States didn't have a park service until 1960. And then the National Parks Act of 1930 was very important. But then there was an amendment to that act in 1988, that was after my undergraduate degree, and this is influenced how parks have been managed. And then in 2000, we had a new Parks Act. So in 1930, the act said that parks were for the benefit, education, and enjoyment of Canada's, leave them unimpaired for future generations. This is what we call the dual mandate. Parks are for human use, but should be left unimpaired, unchanged, they're to be preserved. In 1988, there was an amendment, and this amendment related to park zoning and visitor use, so two parts of park management, and now maintenance of ecological integrity through the protection of natural resources shall be the first priority. So now, instead of this sort of dual mandate, although it's still sort of there, and even the unimpaired, now maintenance of ecological integrity becomes the priorities. And then in 2000, ecological integrity in the new act is applied to all aspects of management, so that this concept needs to be applied to all management within parks. And then ecological integrity means that with respect to a park, a condition that is determined to be characteristic of natural region as likely to persist, including abiotic components and composition abundance of native species and biological communities, rates of change and supporting processes. So this is the concept then that guides all management of parks in national parks in Canada. Now just as a brief aside, Canada doesn't have a Wilderness Act like the United States does. The United States passed the Wilderness Act in 1964. They define wilderness as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by people. And so the author of that act said, we must not forget we are guardians, not gardeners. I'm going to go back and talk about that when I talk about a Christian response to what I'm thinking about today. Now, Norm Hovitz here, my master supervisor at Region wrote, "The American solution to use is to use most of the land intensively and even destructively, but to leave large tracts of land untouched as wilderness areas." So this idea of wilderness is really a very American idea of pristine wilderness areas. In Canada, and I've written about this in a few papers, we have much more of an idea historically and philosophically in terms of combining a harmony of use and preservation. Now, I want to come back to that textbook that I've used four different editions of over the last 20 years. The first edition, which I used as a TA for Paul Eagles when I was a PhD student, and Paul actually had a chapter in the book called Environmental Management in Parks. And he outlined three different approaches to park management. One is that man should watch, not interfere. Management should be hands off as much as possible. So basically, parks are there for people to study nature, and we want to try and minimize as much as possible the human visitor impact upon the park. So leaving them unimpaired for future generations. Then another approach, he said, is we cannot leave nature to its own devices in a park. Active management intervention in nature is inevitable. And then a third is our duty to manage nature, humans are given the obligation to civilize the park. Now, in this chapter, there's no sort of preference. He's just saying these are three approaches that take place. I'm going to skip for a moment to the third one. It is our duty to manage nature. Humans are given domination over the earth and have the right, indeed, the obligation to manage, cleaning up, civilizing, beautifying nature. Now, this most often happens in municipal parks, but here's a few examples in Canadian national parks. So this is Lake Louise, both these pictures, so you can see the sort of ideas of horticulture and civilization here. Banff National Park, you have the Banff Springs Hotel, the golf course. Here's Cape Breton National Park, the golf course. So again, so the idea of civilizing the park. And, okay, so the second option then, he said, with active management and intervention in nature is inevitable. And he gives an example of Point Pelee National Park, which extends into Lake Erie in southern Ontario, which is actually the southernmost part of Canada. And just before he wrote his chapter, in the 1980s, there were record high levels of water. So this sticks out into Lake Erie. And so because of the high water levels, there was erosion of the beaches, waves were coming in, water was coming into the forest, being flooded, and some of these marshes were being eroded or damaged. And so the question then for park managements, what managers, what are they going to do? And he says there's a variety of views. So the idea is that water levels are changing. That is a natural act. Therefore, we should not do anything. Another view was, well, the reason why there was changes was because elsewhere on Lake Erie, where there used to be cliffs, and they used to be eroded, and used to be transportation of sediment to the beaches, now there's anti-erosion measures there, which means there's no longer a supply of that sand coming to the beaches. And therefore, there's remedial actions that should be taken because human action somewhere else has affected the park, and therefore we should do what nature used to do by itself. And a third approach would be, we really don't understand it. These two seem to suggest we have to understand why these changes are taking place. But a third view is, well, we really don't understand what's going on, so maybe it's best not to do anything. And so what they did at Point Pelee Park, they did some minor action and took a number of actions, offshore pilings, concrete structures, to try and trap sand and keep the shoreline as it was. Now, he contrasts that with what happened across the other side of the lake in Presque Isle State Park in Pennsylvania. And so he describes here that it was much more active intervention. So they dumped millions of tons of sand onto the exposed beaches, and that buffered the waves, and so there was very little beach erosion. So he contrasts a very minimal involvement with a very heavy involvement in the United States side. Now, point out here is this was a state park. The action that might have been taken in the United States might have been different if this was a national park. Okay, so that was the first edition of this textbook, which I used when I was a PhD student. And then the second edition sort of took a different approach. And that particular chapter by Paul Eagles was replaced by a chapter by Stephen Woodley, and who at that point in time was the chief ecosystem scientist of Parks Canada, and he had done his PhD thesis on managing for ecosystem integrity at the University of Waterloo. So he talks about historically we let nature take its course and management should be minimal. Now notice that the previous edition of the book talked about management for the environment, now it's talking about plan management for ecological integrity. However, he does point out that even though this was the approach, often there were a number of exceptions. For example, predators were often shot because it was felt that they were disturbing deer or elk populations. And also wildfire suppression was quite a common occurrence in parks. So then he says that these past efforts of just letting nature take its course, comes out, he says, it's misguided. So there's a value judgment, which wasn't in the previous edition of the book. And it's this hands-off laissez-faire is inconsistent with the goal of maintaining or enhancing ecological integrity, and that active management may be needed in the parks, or else species might be lost. Okay, the third edition basically takes the same idea that in the past there's this natural wilderness view, and now ecological integrity supersedes the notion of natural as a management endpoint. And in the fourth edition, the most recent, 2016, it talks about the significant and controversial paradigm shift. So active management is necessary, and we aren't to allow natural processes to take their own course. I want to give you a case study. So one of the advantages of teaching a course like this in Ottawa is that I have opportunity from staff of Parks Canada to come to my class and give talks. So I had Stephen Woodley come a number of times, and he's the chief ecosystem scientist. He works with IUCN now. And he would talk about all these active management projects across the country that he was ultimately the supervisor of. And so this was one case that he did back in 2011. This is Point Pelee. So this is the farmland. Oops, I keep getting mixed up between the pointer. Here's the farmland, and the park is here. See some of the marshes. And then there was this portion south of the tip of Point Pelee that was added in 2000. It was transferred to Nature Conservancy of Canada, and it has special preservation zone. There's five zones in Parks Canada. This is the most significant preservation zone. And what was happening here is that the number of nests of double-crested cormorants had been increasing, as you can see, very evident. And so there were several reasons, I won't go over these details, but there are several reasons why they thought that this particular species was increasing. So here you have it down here, but then it was threatening these other species of birds that also lived on the island. And this is what basically a variety of processes are happening, which was destroying the vegetation. So it had potential to be look like this. And here's another island in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where you can see over a period of time where the vegetation gradually was diminished, and so there was no trees left on the island. So they wanted to prevent on Middle Island what had happened here in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And they had, this is analysis of the canopy over the island, and you can see the canopy had been decreasing from 1995 to 2005-2006. So they came up with a conservation plan. And the key part of this plan over 5 years is to cull the adult breeding birds. Physically remove the nests. And so nesting density reduced through culling from 4,688 nests to 642 to 1,080 nests over the 5 years. And they had different zones within the Middle Island. So the culling began over 5,800 in those years. They removed the nests and so on. And so the idea then was to reduce it. The only way they thought this would work effectively was through culling. And so this thought I had a slide that showed how successful it was, but maybe I did. But the point was, at the end, when he talked about this, he didn't give us a slide. He talked about they were sued, Parks Canada was sued by a fringe or radical environmental group at the time because they were doing the culling and had observers there when doing the culling. And this went online, and recently there's an article by this organization that's criticizing Parks Canada for this, and here's a statement they make. Sadly, Parks Canada clings to a museum or guarding approach to management, trying to maintain an arbitrarily fixed state of ecological affairs through its relentless war on wildlife. So they're being criticized for their approach, which is attempting to manage for ecological integrity. Next, I want to give another example. This is a much more most recent example. So last year I had Dr. Jill Sutan come. He's now the current chief ecosystem scientist for Parks Canada and the Squamish National Park Reserve off the BC coast. And what was happening there was that seabirds are being threatened by an invasive rat. And these are the couple of islands. This is islands where they eradicated the rats from. And they tried different ways to eradicate it, but eventually they used these helicopters, which had buckets, and the buckets would swing, and they all figured out how they could do it. They'd have enough poison that would kill the rats. And so here you can see that the increase of these seabirds, so that it was an effective way of eliminating the invasive species. Now, the reason why I want to show this example was this last slide here. I think in my abstract, I talked about how Parks Canada is a leader in terms of ecological integrity. So this is what he told my class. First and still only protected area system in the world. So Parks Canada, National Parks, is the first and still only protected area system in the world that operates at an integrated system-wide mechanism of ecological integrity monitoring, restoration, prioritization, planning, and resource allocation. We allocate $50 million annually to large-scale priority ecological restoration projects. So he was, you know, really claiming, you know, what a great job Parks Canada is doing. We're leaders in the world. So what do we think about this then as Christians? And one of the words that has come up is the idea of guardians. We saw that the author of the U.S. Wilderness Act used the word guardian. And then we also seen the word gardener. We heard the word gardener earlier this morning, I think, in the devotion. And so this is, I showed this quote already, that the author of the U.S. Wilderness Act said, we must never forget we are guardians, not gardeners. So the idea is that we should refrain from becoming involved in managing these wilderness areas or national parks, refrain from actions that manipulate, control, or intervene with the ecological system. And the idea of this then was to establish a relationship with people and the land based on restraint, humility, and respect. So instead of actively engaging, you refrain from manipulating and you develop a respectful relationship. And so there's a book chapter by Londres who gives a number of reasons why a hands-off approach should be taken. It deepens respect for nature, it fosters scientific humility, it accepts evolutionary change. We sustain non-focal species. That is, instead of focusing on species we want to introduce, we want to remove, then all the other species are sustained. It reduces unintended adverse consequences. Whenever you take active management, you're never quite sure what the outcomes are going to be. There could be adverse consequences. Provides unmanipulated benchmarks to use, and you preserve options and hedge your risks for the future. Now, Stephen Boomer Prediger, some of you might be familiar with, doesn't necessarily endorse wilderness areas per se, because he says lots of other nature that's just as beautiful. We sort of give too much attention to wilderness. But I think his comment here might be a little bit relevant to talk about the benefits of a hands-off approach. He says, the movement to preserve wilderness is in keeping with the spirit of Job's wild nature poetry. As such, it represents a position that removes the human from the center of things, thus engendering humility and fostering hospitality to our non-human neighbors. So it sort of reflects some of those benefits from the previous slide. However, in that part of his book, he also talks about when nature is the center, it's not necessarily reflecting a Christian view, because in a Christian view, God is at the center. We have a theocentric view. I want to come back to this question then. are we gardeners or guardians? And so the author of the U.S. Wilderness Act would say we should be guardians. But this other author says, is it our responsibility to correct our past mistakes to facilitate the healing process? Embrace our role as gardeners as the only responsible way to sustain wildlife. So this person is arguing that we should be gardeners rather than guardians. Well, let's look at scripture. And we had this read for us in the devotional, I believe, this morning, or some of the same ideas. And I'm taking this from my master supervisor, Lauren Wilkinson. And so you're familiar then with Genesis 1 and 2. Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth, and do it, and rule over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So to subdue means to tread down, to bring into bondage. To rule means to trample, to press. And so Wilkinson says, humans are placed over the rest of creation, expresses a superiority. But then you have that balance with Genesis 2:15. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to keep it. To till means to work, to serve, to be a slave to, and keep means to keep or watch or preserve. And then, quote, Wilkinson again, the kind of tilling which is to be done is a service of the earth. The keeping of the garden is not just for human comfort, but is a kind of preservation. Both verbs severely restrict the way the other two verbs, subdue and rule, are to be applied. Human ruling, then, should be exercised in such a way as to serve and preserve the beast, the earth itself, and all which is being ruled. So when we read this, the guard and the till and keep it might suggest, then, that we are to be gardeners. But when you actually read how these verbs are, it doesn't necessarily have to be till. It could be work or serve. And then Wilkinson says, a kind of preservation. So you can also maybe argue that not only are we to be guardians from that verse, but that could also interpret we are to be guardians in the sense that the author of the Wilderness Act is using, because part of that verse may suggest to preserve. Now, a number of other Christian authors have talked about this idea that we have a special role, we're overseeing things. And so Brian says, any moral formation of Christian conservationists must involve a careful theological analysis of this idea. The conservation of biodiversity depends on a willingness of human beings to accept that we are responsible for species and ecosystems. And I'll drop down here. A theology that takes science seriously must affirm human dominion, and we must do our best to live out that dominion as faithful servants. So there's some suggestion that maybe we do more than just sit back and let nature be in terms of wilderness areas or natural areas. And then another Christian author, Loving Nature, Ecological Integrity, and the Christian Responsibility, talks about the guardianship of biodiversity. An ecologically sound and ethically responsible public policy provides protection for non-human species, ensuring the conditions necessary for perpetuation and ongoing evolution. This role of guardian of biodiversity is for Christians an expression of genuine dominion and respect for our spiritual and biological kinship and connections with other creatures in acknowledgement of their intrinsic value and in totality to the biocentric valuations of God. So in some senses, then, some people use the word guardian in a way that other people also use the word gardener. But I think the key idea is that of humility, as Nash talks about. The guardianship of biodiversity is empowered by humility. The whole of nature cannot be defined by human purposes and wants. It has its own integrity under God that defies human arrogance and demands human respect and protection. So whether we think of it as gardening or guardian, that humility needs to be associated with our actions or management actions in terms of hearts. So we might say that a laissez-faire approach, the old traditional approach, a hands-off approach, might be biocentric because we are allowing, we're thinking that nature knows best, so we'll leave it alone. But then what about managing for ecological integrity, which is the approach that Parks Canada now uses? Is that an anthropocentric approach? So with one of my graduate classes, this term, we had a little bit of discussion, and they thought it was anthropocentric approach, or is it a theocentric approach? Or could it be both? In this latest edition, there's a new chapter that wasn't in previous editions of the book on climate change. And the first time I read it, I got the end of it. This is really, really, really anthropocentric. It seemed to say we did X, Y, and Z, we're going to solve the climate change issues as it relates to parks. And there was something about that chapter that really bothered me. So you could say that managing for ecological integrity could be anthropocentric, it could be theocentric, it probably depends on the approach you take to it. I want to end, my time is up. I want to end by personal story example. My first job I had after I finished my undergraduate degree was work for the Sierra Club of Western Canada in Calgary, and I helped them with a number of projects. One was, at that point in time, the Trans-Canada Highway was going to be twinned between, through the eastern part of Banff National Park. So we argued against it. When we went to the meetings, the public meetings, truck drivers were arguing for the twinning of the Trans-Canada Highway, and skiers were going to Lake Louise, wanted the twinning because it gets them back and forth between Calgary and Booker. And we said, well, you have a four-lane highway, there's going to be more animals killed. And so it was passed and approved, and then they built underpasses, and that worked for some animals, but not for others, so then they made overpasses. Now, Stephen Woodley, who I've mentioned a number of times, he says in terms of managed ecological integrity, there's two things. One is you may want to increase a species, bring back a species. Another is extend a range through corridors. He says the second is the more difficult, and this is the type of thing that you did here in Banff Park. So after he came to my class and gave a presentation one day, and he talked about these overpasses, underpasses, I said, well, back in 1982, whenever I worked for the Sierra Club, I said, we argued against it. And he said, well, I think it's better now with a four-lane highway, with the underpasses, the overpasses, and the fencing on the other side than it was with a two-lane highway. So that was sort of a bit of humility for me, because we thought with the Sierra Club, we were arguing what was best. So that just takes me back to the point I made that I think maybe that came out this morning, maybe in the keynote, the idea of humility. And so I don't know yet. I'm thinking about whether managing for ecological integrity is more anthropocentric or theocentric, but I think humility is a really important value you need to have when you're managing for ecological integrity. It's a very anthropocentric way where you think that humans always have the answer. I think it could be dangerous. I think theocentric position would help us have that humility to solve those problems.
That's it. Thanks, Paul. I appreciated that. Does anyone have any questions?
What is the current approach utilized by the U.S. National Park Service? And second to that, to what extent do Parks Canada and the U.S. National Park Service put their heads together?
Well, that they do work together. It reintroduced wolves into the Yellowstone Park. So the U.S. Park Service does a lot of this too. Parks Canada would say they're the leaders. They started it. And in my class, Stephen Woodley would say, he's giving the example. In the United States, if there was a fire, they would go and suppress it. They would first try and figure out what the cause was. If the cause was a human, they would put it out. If it was not human, they would not put it out. And he says in Canada, we don't care. We're not concerned about what the cause is. So in Canada, they have to strike burns, and they want to reintroduce the traditional fire regime. Right? So there are some subtle differences. He could probably answer that question better than I could, but I would say Canada's been a little bit ahead, but the United States is also doing as well.
Real quick. Of course, we know that the national parks are different from provincial parks and the jurisdictions around them. They also are overlapped with indigenous peoples' territories or traditional lands. So I'm just wondering if you could speak a bit about the governance or the challenges that are around that in managing for ecological integrity.
Well, over the last 20-30 years, there's been a lot more Aboriginal involvement in parks. And so particularly in the northern parks, new parks are established. The Aboriginal people are very keen to have parks. And so there's a number of parks that have been established that have been co-management. And then in some areas, like I know some of the historian Nakota people around Banff have become much more involved in the management of Banff National Park. So there's been more and more involvement, and actually it's almost easier now to establish parks where Aboriginal people are, because they're very keen at having parks that have their land protected, than in other areas where it's been developed, or in southern parts of Canada was difficult this action.
Thanks. Let's swing Paul one more time.